Robert Berry, and welcome to Retro Crush, the podcast, episode 69. Today I'm going to be interviewing a friend of mine named Bob Moritz, and Bob is a great avant-garde, crazy filmmaker, musician, based here in Sacramento, California, and a film of his called Palace of Stains is going to be playing on the big screen of the Crest Theater this Friday, March 24th in Sacramento at 11 p.m. And we'll have a link on how you can get there. And a lot of us Retro Crushers are going to be there, and I hope to see you guys there too. But Bob's a great guy. He's got a lot of great influences, and we're going to talk a bit about his work, what went into making this movie, and you'll learn about this movie as well. And we're going to play a song of his at the end of the podcast that I hope you stick around for. So without further ado, here is our interview with Bob Moritz, director of Palace of Stains, which opens this Friday in Sacramento at the Crest Theater. So if you're anywhere close to California, see you there. All right, well, we've got local filmmaker, musician, and friend to man and beast alike, Bob Moritz, here on our podcast here right now. Bob, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great, and I prefer beasts to men.
You prefer beasts to men?
Yes.
Which, if you had to choose one beast to accompany you on an island, what do you think that would be?
To accompany me?
Yeah, if you could only choose one beast to have on an island with you.
It would probably be a pussy cat.
I know what you're saying, man. I think I would choose, like, an elephant.
Because why?
Because there'd be so much of it, and you could be creative with it as it remains, you know? Like,
that's
you could eat
point,
some of it someday, you know, maybe build a house out of part of its bones, sculpt yourself an elephant flesh love sleeve. Well, hey, Bob's got this in the Sacramento, the lovely Crest Theater is going to be premiering on March 24th, this Friday at 11. One night only, the new film Palace of Stains. This is a feature-length film. And Bob, what tell us a little bit about what this movie's all about here.
Well, Palace of Stains, it's about three warring families in a ritzy, hoity-toity kind of town. And two of them have been kind of battling each other for several generations, and this new upstart family comes in on the, you know, pretty much on the back of all the money that the son, Methuselah Agrippa, made on his televangelist ministry. And everybody hates them, of course, because they're new money, and everybody's just doing terrible things to each other and doing nasty things and kind of trying to bring the other one down, as people are wont to do, you know. It's a movie about human nature and all the nasty shades of it.
Yeah, yeah, definitely there's a lot of bad parts of human nature out there. Well, now with this is a pretty hedonistic movie. I will put a link to the trailer here, so if you want to just go to the podcast page, you could check this out. But I mean, there's like, you know, the devil's in this trailer, and there's this chick getting a gun put in her mouth, and I think she kind of kisses it, you know, once it's there. And there's like hot tub action and axe murderer crazy stuff going on, and some guy that looks like the Invisible Man getting threatened.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned about the chick kissing the gun. It's actually a man who plays that role, and it's also it's kind of, it sums it all up, you know. It's what life is. When you get a gun stuck to your mouth, you just gotta kiss it, you know. That's what it's all about.
Those are kind of words to live by for us all.
Exactly.
So really, exactly. This movie is sort of a parable for our time.
100% right. You've got it on the nose, Robert.
Now, this was a pretty amazing endeavor, because this film was shot during a very small time frame. I believe, if correct me, how many days from like for the main photography was this put together? It was a real marathon session, wasn't it?
That was one day for the main stuff. About 80% of the stuff was shot in one day.
Right. So, I mean, aside from the extra little post-production things, I mean, it was a what Bob has done for this film, Palace of Stains, is he pretty much sent out this open call to almost all of the creative and artist and actor types in Sacramento, and it was just like this, I think you had four directors counting yourself putting this together?
Exactly. I had Dutch Falcone helping me out, Jonathan Morkin, and Jay Greenberg. They were all shooting simultaneously, and we, you know, before the shoot, I had to kind of arrange where everyone's going to be at a certain time because a lot of the actors were, you know, had to change their locations, and yeah, it was very hectic and crazy, and it took 20 years off my life.
Yeah, I mean, I could just imagine. I mean, I have a tough enough time just putting a 20-minute podcast together, alone.
No, none of this is easy stuff.
What's amazing to me, and I saw the first film that you did, The Midnight of My Life,
mm-hmm.
and that was a shorter film, right? It was about, what, about a 30-minute film, wasn't it?
It was actually like an hour long.
About
I'm glad
hour.
You thought it was. Most people say that it's they think it's 2 hours, but it's actually an hour long, so I like that you said it.
But I thought it was a half hour. Yeah, it was so good. I was like, wow, is it over already? But, I mean, no, this is how long is this film here?
This is about 90 minutes. It's about 98 minutes exactly.
So this is your first, quote, feature-length film that you've
made? Well, I've made one that was about 70 minutes. I have another one that's 75. Midnight was 60. This is definitely my longest one. The first cut of this was actually about 2 hours and 45 minutes.
Wow.
So, it was ridiculous. I had to whittle it down like crazy because, I mean, one, it's showing at 11, you know, so I don't want to make people fall asleep. And two, it's just better for it. Like, I don't like these director's cuts where they have, like, these three-hour versions of a movie that was perfectly fine before they added all this, you know, unnecessary
exactly.
stuff to it. Yeah.
Now this is I have to say, I haven't seen the film yet. I'll be watching the premiere along with everyone else there. But from the footage I've seen so far, it seems like a pretty, a pretty well put together and cohesive, pretty crazy film. There looks like it's a pretty. You've got it's pretty much your typical over the top kind of movie here. You've got slasher scenes, sexy scenes, just crazy cross-dressing, dramatic scenes, a lot of weird costumes, weird characters. I mean, it looks like it's just full of great, great stuff. Was it pretty close to your original vision when you were, writing this and conceiving it, and when it actually came out, was it pretty close to what you were looking for by the time it all came together?
Well, the vision had a lot to do with other people's vision. You know, when I sent out the e-bite to everyone, I mean, I asked everyone to tell me what they want to play. You know, what's the character that would really grab you and you could have a lot of fun to do. And
really playing on the strengths of the people, yeah.
Exactly, yeah. So I just built on whatever they wanted, and that really kind of influenced where the script was going to go. And I wrote the script in 2 weeks. I had 2 weeks to write this thing so people would have 2 weeks to learn their lines, which isn't that much time anyway for something this big. And, somehow I got it done, but it was easy to do because so much of it was already, you know, like when you've got a certain kind of combination, you know, a man who wants to play a woman, a Satanist, you know, blah, blah, blah. You know, televangelist, there's only so many things you can do with that, you know.
Which I thought was rather funny because Keith Lowell Jensen, who's a frequent guest on our podcast and contributor to the website, I noticed he's playing a against type, a Bible thumping televangelist type in your movie. Did he request for a part like that there, or did you just think that was so perfect he had to do that?
I really see him as that. I think I don't remember if he requested it or not, but I mean, whether he did or not, or whether it was my imagination, it's just such a great with his voice and his cadences. It's the perfect role for Keith.
For sure. Now, in this film, you got some pretty racy things going on. It's an unrated film, obviously, so it's pretty much a late night adult film.
I would say so.
But now you managed to get a semi-realistic orgy scene put in this film? Or an actual orgy scene put in this film? Maybe I'm sugarcoating this too much. How'd that all work out?
Well, you know, originally it was in the script that there was going to be an orgy scene, and, you know, I sent out the email to the actors, you know, and it's like, hey, who wants to be part of an orgy scene? And, you know, surprisingly, very few takers, you know. But,
I almost volunteered, but it was kind of cold that time of year, so I was afraid, you know.
Yeah, it's better in the summer for orgy scenes, no doubt. Good 100-degree day, you know. Yeah.
Exactly.
But, yeah, it just kind of worked out. You know, we had one of the actors had some ties, and it was actually shot in the San Francisco Center for Sex and Culture, I believe. So they have interesting props and
backgrounds.
Oh,
yeah, the SSSC. Yeah, I know that place.
Yeah.
The San sure. Francisco Center for Sex and Culture.
Yeah.
And orgy room.
Well, you know,
that's pretty cool. So how long has that organization been around? Are they looking after the sex culture pretty ardently for folks there?
You know, I don't know. You know, it was actually at the point where I was just kind of going nuts and trying to get everything edited in time for the premiere. And Nick Roberts, one of the actors who plays Lauren Cosgrave in the movie, he kind of set it up. I just told him, I'm all, listen, you know, if you can find the actors. Because I was originally going to cut it out. I was just going to, like, leave it out of the movie altogether. But he was pretty willing and intent on getting it, you know, making it happen, you know. And I'm not going to shrink in the face of that, you know. So I let him run with it, and I had a couple of friends. And it was going to be shot in the Bay Area because a lot of the participants were from the Bay Area. So I got some Bay Area friends of mine, like Kurt Stumbaugh and Eric Ipsen, who always helped me out and shoot stuff and act in my movies. And they shot all that stuff. For the orgy. I had nothing to do with it, actually. They're just kind of, the actor, you know, Nick arranged the actors and all the costumes and the props and everything, and Eric and Kurt showed up and they shot it, and then I just got the footage back, and I just edited it all together and put the music that Optical Pies Orchestra put together for me.
Wow, that's fun. Now you did shoot. Now, were you the director for the hot tub scene in this film?
I did not. Whoa, yeah, I was there for that.
It's like all the good scenes got farmed out to other directors, huh? You got to do the cross-dresser talking to a lady in a dining room scene. That was your choice bit. Well,
that was Dutch Falcone, actually. I got some juicy stuff. I'm not going to let myself go without, you know.
I think, you know, it's funny, and you mentioned Jonathan Morkin is one of the directors on here. He was laughing in that, you know, you could put a film together, and if it's not a porn film, if it's like a legitimate movie, it's funny how you can just get up-and-coming actresses to do just all these, like, outrageous scenes that you know, for free, just that drop your jaw, you know, they're like, you know, they're willing to do, you know, simulated hotel sex scenes or things like that, you know, just, and he was showing his film Noir to me, and there's this woman in this film that's just doing all these number of things, and...
Oh, I remember that, yeah.
And I asked, how much did you pay her to be in this movie? He's like, nothing. Like, what, she's just doing all this stuff for free? He's like, yeah, she just wanted it on her resume. Like, wow, that's the angle there, I guess.
It depends on the person, you know. Some people are pretty willing, and I think, you know, a lot of people have a major streak of exhibitionism. It's kind of... You know, it's kind of healthy. It's kind of good for everyone. And, you know, people who have are willing.
Well, I suppose it kind of helps when you actually have a body of work that's shown in theaters before. So it's not like you're just some dude on Craigslist. You know, I'm making a movie. Come to my garage.
Exactly.
But, well, that's great. So now this is going to be playing at the Crest Theater. And you've played at the Crest Theater before, but this is going to be pretty nice in that you've actually secured the giant big screen for this. So this is going to be in the 900 plus capacity big screen theater. Is that pretty exciting for you there?
It is exciting, and it's pretty stressful too, you know, because there's like, you know, before it was like the 200 seats, and I was stressed about filling that, and now 925, that's a whole lot bigger, whole many more seats to fill. And yes, you know, hopefully, you know, we'll get a few fannies in there, you know, but still, it's stressful, yes.
I mean, in the past, you've had almost so many people in your films that practically if they just show up with a friend and buy a ticket, that could, you know, sell out some of the smaller screens. But, yeah, that's got to be a little daunting to see a theater that size in front of you there. But I think it's a good sign, and it's really nice, obviously, with digital camera work now. I mean, some stuff like this feasible, and with the Crest Theater and other theaters now actually incorporating digital projection into their theater system, it actually looks great, you know, to the audience members as well. So that's pretty cool there. I mean, so what kind of cameras were you using for this film?
Oh, a whole bunch of different kinds. You know, we're using, of course, there's like one set where they're lucky enough where two of the camera people had the same camera, like a Canon XL1, I believe, or an XL2. I don't remember what it was. I just like asked everyone.
It's like one of the more top of the line commercial ones. I mean, one of the consumer ones. That's like the way high end one.
Yeah, or they call them prosumer, where it's like that netherworld between professional and consumer. Where I mean, they really make nice broadcast quality kind of stuff. And I just bought myself, well, back then, you know, a year ago when I shot this thing, a Panasonic, and for The numbers escape me right now, but you know, it's also a prosumer model. It costs me a good amount of money, and it makes a big difference. The stuff looks really good. It's shocking how, you know, I just had the tech check last week, and it looks really good up on the big screen. And you know, it's just video being projected 150 feet. I mean, it's an interesting time. It's a good time. You know, things are. Doors opening a little bit. You don't have to spend, you know, thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars on film anymore to make something with a good visual impact and pretty look at, you know?
Sure. I mean, back in the day, I mean, half your budget was just buying the film stock and processing it and making the print. And with, you know, the digital, you pretty much just have the initial camera cost and your software sweating of just editing the thing, you know, and then. But I mean, even editing's got to be so much easier digitally too. I mean, you could just trim and move and slice around and not have to worry about all the post production there stuff for sure.
So oh my God, it's so much better.
What's something like I mean, now with Palace of Stains, you had the benefit from just having a really great network of friends that were, you know, contributing their services to be a part of this project. So that really kind of helps keep the budget down pretty dramatically, I imagine.
Absolutely, yeah.
So what's something like this ultimately cost? Even with that kind of help, there's still some cost to it, I'm sure, considering the promotion and advertising and everything else. I mean, it's what's if someone were to try to duplicate what you've done here, what would they have probably looked at probably shelling out range-wise?
I mean, golly, with everything, like, I mean, with promotion, I mean, promotion eats up a lot of it, you know? I mean, like, making all the posters, making all the flyers, making the, you know, like, I'll be, you know, selling DVDs at the show, so making all the DVDs for the show, I mean, it's a lot. I mean, just that, like, the DVDs were over $1,000. But, I mean, if I don't count producing stuff that isn't of the movie, I mean, probably, I don't know, between $1,000 and $1,500, I think, like, for everything.
That's pretty good to have a 90-minute film under your belt for that. I mean, that's, you know, I defy most filmmakers to put something of this high of a quality out and escape with that little of a cost when all said and done. Especially when you're doing all your own promotion. I mean, that's amazing.
Well, I have no choice. You know, I don't roll in the big bucks, so I have to make every dollar count as much as I possibly can.
Well, and it's really nice that you're actually going to be selling DVDs after the show. I think that's a trend that you. In fact, I think it was Steven Soderbergh just released a film called Bubble, and it was an interesting where it was theatrical, cable, and DVD simultaneously released.
Yeah,
and it was a small film, and it worked really well and helped expose the audience. And I think, you know, I'd like to see more of that. Like you're going to a concert in a way where, you know, you go to a concert and you buy the merchandise and the T-shirts. I think, you know, as people leave the screening of a movie. You know, they may be more willing to spend 15 to 20 on that DVD on the way out, you know, and really, you know, it's an extra way to make money for that film without having to wait the standard, you know, 3 to 5 months for it to come out on DVD, you know, but,
yeah, it depends on the movie. You know, if you don't like the movie, you're not going to want to buy it. Mr. Lobo once said to me that it's like, trying to sell DVDs after showing a movie is like trying to, feed someone who had like a 5-course meal pizza, you know? So I don't know if that's true. I mean, we'll see. You know, I mean, it's like I'm not selling anything that I'm not selling Palace Stains DVDs. Like I'm going to wait on that. You know, but I'll be selling other
stuff.
Oh, I see.
You're not selling DVDs of this film at the show.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
It's like other stuff, like Midnight of My Life, like people who came out to see that, hopefully they'll be back to see this and they'll go, oh man, I want to see that again. And there's some, bonus features on there. I actually shot a lot of the opening night. So anyone who came to the opening night, might see themselves, you know, there's like a half hour segment where you see the performance of Las Pesadillas and like, you know, just all the tomfoolery that went on with Mr. Lobo's, introduction and narration and all that stuff, you know, so it's an added little bonus.
Yeah, now speaking of Las Pesadillas, you they recorded the soundtrack for The Midnight of My Life. And
yes.
That's actually available on iTunes, too, so if anybody out there wants to look up Las Pesadillas, you can find that on iTunes rather easily, and Bob actually has a track on that soundtrack as well. Was it the Hairy Scary...
The Hairy Scary Pig Man, yeah.
Yeah, but it's a pretty... Now, to kind of seg over to that, I mean, you not only are you doing all this film work, but, I mean, you've got a lot of just fun and remarkably... I don't know what the right word is I'm trying to think of here, but just really original and mind-blowing songs that are really great to listen to. People can check that out if they go to... BobBarango.com, Barango. And so now what about you kind of have a kind of, is that, do you consider that your musical art alter ego so that you can separate that from the film stuff that you do? Or
yeah, Bob Barango's my musical art alter ego. I also have a MySpace page. It's like MySpace/BobBarango, but it's like I don't know, I always felt like movies are my wife and music is my mistress. You know, so I kind of have to disguise myself. I have to, you know, crawl through some CD alleys with a overcoat on, you know, for the music realm, you know, because movies were always my first love, but along the way, just rock and roll, you know, just killed me. It's a lot of fun to do. And I really like doing it. And I try to stick it in my movies. I do I sing the, theme song for Palace of Stains, and, Jason Cox, he did like, all the music behind it, you know, he's like a genius producer. He did the majority of the music for what's it called, Palace of Stains, along with the help of Noah Nelson and Damien Soul. So like, you know, three quarters of Las Pesadillas, and you know, he did an amazing job. They all did a great job.
Yeah, now we're gonna have a link to the trailer on our podcast page here, but the song on the trailer is was like something about the Funhouse.
Yeah, Funhouse of Love.
Funhouse of Love. I mean, that's a great song as well. And I know we're going to play a couple of your songs on this podcast, so I'm going to just generically talk because I'm not sure which one we're going to end up playing here. But,
oh, yeah, totally.
But definitely some great stuff. I really like a lot of the themes of your music are very, you know, filled with just zombies and craziness, violence, apocalyptic type fun things, you know. It's sort of just... laughing in the face of destruction is a lot of the attitude I get from some of this stuff. Now, an album I've got of yours, I can't remember if it... What was, the title of this album was...
The Acoustic One, Small Fall, that one?
It's called Small what?
The Small Fall, the acoustic record.
Small Fall, right. Yeah, that was fun because it was recorded entirely in your kitchen, right?
Yeah, and one day I just kind of cranked it all out, yeah.
Yeah, and it's really got a great feel to it. In fact, it's funny, I was reading the credits on your CD, and it talks about you gave the mailman a credit for ringing the doorbell during one of your songs.
Yeah, it's everyone who played on it. I sang it and played the guitar, and then the postman rang the doorbell once or twice during one of the songs, and you can kind of hear it, you know, and it added something nice, so I wanted to give him some credit, you know. Or her. It might have been a post lady. I don't know.
That's great stuff. So what would you recommend to some folks out there? I know I've been to your house, and you got a lot of great avant-garde underground movies and things like that. And I know you're a big David Lynch fan.
Heck yeah.
What do you like most about David Lynch? What are some of the things you like about him, I should say?
kind of like his the way he owns him into the dream world. I mean, that really kind of stuck with me, and that's kind of like helped me forge my path, because not really caring so much about a straight ahead narrative and having all the traditional structure elements in place. It's more about like kind of tapping into what's going on deep within the human soul and kind of splattering that up on the screen, you know, in a weird kind of subconscious way, and kind of being true, you know, finding the direct link between your subconscious and your waking thought, you know, and kind of making some sense of that, because there's a lot of messy, crazy things in there that we can all really learn from, you know. Like I used to do lucid dreaming and stuff for a short while, but it's a lot of work, so I couldn't really keep up with it, and I found a lot of interesting information, and kind of, you know, like when you really kind of listen to your dreams, you can find out, I don't know, better ways to lead your life, you know?
Yeah, there's definitely a lot of cool stuff in the dream worlds there. That's pretty, yeah. I used to study this astral projection stuff.
Yeah.
When I was a kid, I used to have all these like pretty consistent flying dreams, and so I was trying to I was reading that those are supposedly the conscious recollections of you flying. I mean, astral projecting. You know, so when you dream of flying, that's kind of like you really did leave your body and you're flying around, but.
Did you get anywhere? Did you like actually like feel like you were able to go into other people's consciousness and stuff?
You know, I think a lot of it was that I just wasn't committing to the rigors of keep practicing it. You know, I was like,
yeah.
I'd go through the stuff in these books to kind of, you know, so that you could astral project at will. And I'd have some fun experiences that I think I could tie to that, but nothing to the point where, like, you know, I could make this nightly trip around town or wherever I wanted to go and fly. But yeah, probably for the same reasons you couldn't keep up with your lucid dreaming stuff. I mean,
it's hard work. Yeah.
So obviously David Lynch and some other cool filmmakers inspire you. What would be some of the guilty pleasure movies in your collection that people wouldn't expect? Like do you have like a, you know, Pretty in Pink or Zapped or Revenge of the Nerds 3? I mean, are there some movies that you kind of feel guilty for liking that people would not expect Bob to enjoy like that?
That's a good question. I like that question a lot. I think Harold and Kumar Go to White Castle. That I don't know. A lot of times when people are asked this question, I ask people stuff like this, and they always kind of answer stuff that's still cool. You know what I mean? It's like, well, right. Strange Brew. I mean, that movie's really stupid. You know, but no, come on, it's still cool. It's still really funny. Oh, man. That's a tough question, because, you know, you kind of try to sublimate those things, you know, you don't want it to get out, but I think, I don't know, I recently started getting into this, but maybe I'm not that bad. The Princess Bride is a really great movie.
Oh, yeah.
That's not bad.
The characters in that are just so fun.
Yeah, that's a great movie. I'm trying to think, you know, some of the later Texas Chainsaw Massacre movies. I just bought Texas Chainsaw Massacre 3, and I was really embarrassed about that because, you know, I'm a total snob, and the first Texas Chainsaw Massacre, you know, is mind-blowing, sure. And the other ones are just pieces of shit, but I don't know. That one's kind of bad. I'm trying to think.
You ever seen Street Trash?
Yeah, I love that one.
We saw that last night. That was pretty mind-blowing.
It's really mind-blowing. All that
so trashy and unredeeming in any way. I love this scene at the beginning where there's this bum drinking on the street, and these punks just start beating him up, and one of the punks throws up on the bum's face on purpose. And they go running down the street laughing. You're like, oh, my God, that's a pretty severe bum hatred there.
Yeah, that's a special movie. I mean, there's nothing like that one.
Yeah, that's for sure. Hopefully we can get that a trash film orgy someday there.
Yeah.
Well, hey, you know, if anyone out there is remotely in Northern California, you really should check out the Palace of Stains Friday, March 24th at 11 p.m. at the Crest Theater. You can go to thecrest.com to find out more about that. And we'll have some links to Bob's site so you can see some more information about this movie. And Bob, always a pleasure. Thanks for being on our show, and we'll hopefully have a lot of Retro Crush people come in to check out your movie, and Hey, everybody, Bob's really accessible. He's a really fun filmmaker, and he'll be hanging out and talking to people after the movie, I'm sure, and he'll probably buy you a drink, maybe even, huh?
Oh, yeah, you know, I've been known to do that.
So, all right, Bob, well, thanks for talking with us, and we'll see you this Friday at the Crest at 11 o'clock.
Thank you, Robert. I had such a great time talking with you.
All right, talk to you later.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. So that was Bob Maritza, and here is one of his songs. This is called Hot Wired Heart and the Barroom Floor.
Hey there, girls, gather around. Won't you take a listen to what I'm about to put down?
Your heart, goddammit.